Welcome, listeners, to episode 5 of the Jacobs podcast. In this episode, I interview Andrew Cripps, former Minister for Mines and Natural Resources in the Queensland State Government. We touch on his time in state politics, how he caught the bug for current affairs, his principles, a point I think that's really important, and his thoughts on policy going forward at a state and national level. It's a long interview, but one that's full of insight and insight into the sacrifices of policy making that a lot of people simply won't hear today. Happy listening. Okay, well, Andrew Cripps, welcome to the Jacobs podcast.
Thanks very much, Sean. It's a pleasure to be here.
Fantastic. You've now, look, actually, firstly, listeners, we do find ourselves doing this interview in another Brisbane pub, and I apologise because that is not a theme that is intended, but it's just something that keeps happening. And look, we've found a very quiet spot in the Brisbane pub to actually do this. And thank you again, Andrew, for joining us. You've had a really lively political career, and I hope you continue to do. And your interest in current affairs has been really apparent in some of the portfolios you've been able to take on. Andrew, why did you get involved in politics in the first place, and what sparked that interest in current affairs?
I suppose my secondary schooling in Tully in far north Queensland, I was a better student in those social science, humanities, English subjects, and so I was interested in economics, and I was interested in modern history, I was interested in literature, and things like that, and I was obviously involved in debating and public speaking competitions, and so I think that sort of pushed me in the direction of being involved in talking, being involved in advocacy, talking about community issues, but not from an explicitly political perspective until I left secondary school.
Sure.
And I came to Brisbane, to the University of Queensland, where I did undergraduate studies in economics and political science, and I think that's where I really became switched on to politics proper.
Sure.
I'd travelled and visited cities, but it's the first time that I'd lived away from my hometown of Tully.
Sure.
And so coming to Brisbane for the first time, it was a shock to the system to see the opportunity and the availability of opportunity in a major metropolitan centre, as opposed to a small rural town, and that really influenced the development of my politics. If you join that to the situation of studying politics, I was exposed to a lot of material and text from a political philosophy, political ideology, all that sort of stuff that they front-end a political science degree with. And at the time, I was sort of actively considering what my politics was. So it wasn't long before I became involved in the National Party.
Sure.
and enjoyed very much the type of engagement with politics from that perspective as well.
Sure, fantastic. And at university, did you find some of your, I guess, earlier principles or beliefs were challenged and contested in a sort of academic setting? And I imagine that would have been pretty lively as well, you know, especially at university.
Oh, they were very challenged, especially by some of my lecturers and fellow students who didn't share my emerging political views, especially my emerging party political views and my philosophical approach, which I suppose can best be described as strongly associated with, you know, a classical conservative approach to political philosophy and values. And that was difficult because I didn't find that all of my lecturers were as open-minded and as accommodating of all different types of views as they probably should have been.
Sure.
But that's part of life. Mm-hmm. You know, in life you come up against people who haven't been able to take an open-minded and mature approach to things. And you know, I've got lots of friends who don't share my political values and points of view, but we're friends because we can enjoy a very robust debate and a cold pint, and we can get on with being friends and enjoying each other's company for those reasons, rather than, you know, because we've got significant political differences.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
And yeah, look, I do think university, and I certainly share two things with you on that front. You know, one, working backwards, but being a solid testing ground for some of the political beliefs and the philosophies that I held dear, and having to refine those views and argue for those views is something that university really tested me out on. But then also just that, what you were saying about why you got involved, like why you had the affinity for current affairs in the first place, is I had the exact same thing. It's the you know, the social sciences and history and current affairs certainly appealed to me a lot more than science, maths, or you know, physics. It wasn't my jam, wasn't my thing. Look, you know, you came out of university, you obviously got involved in formal politics, and you had what appears to be a very meteoric rise. You were a very young minister, and you know, you had an awesome responsibility, I think, from looking at your CV at a very young age. How did you approach the portfolio, Andrew, and how did you take on a leadership role?
Yeah, coming out of university, when I graduated, I had spent a year doing honours when I finished my degree in economics and my degree in politics. I took an honours year in political science, and I sort of merged the two. Agricultural economics was my major in my economics degree, and I decided to spend a year doing honours in political science, but public policy. And it was looking at my sort of involvement with the sugar industry in North Queensland, was looking at public policy and the way that politics and economic policy interacted with respect to that industry. And that was really interesting. And I'd been state president of the Queensland Young Nationals for 2 years, between 2004 and 2006, before an opportunity came up for me to stand for the state seat back in the community that I grew up in.
Sure. Yeah.
And that was a big opportunity. I was 25 at the time.
Yeah.
And you have to take the opportunity when it presents itself. Mm. So I was young, probably a little bit too young in my view, but I didn't know when another opportunity like that would come along. So I grabbed it with both hands, and I was successful in being elected.
Yeah.
I was elected in 2006, spent 2 years on the backbench, and I went onto the front bench in 2008 as the Shadow Minister for Natural Resources and Water, and then the Shadow Minister for Disabilities and Multicultural Affairs. And that was a really important time for me as a person. I suppose up until that point in time, my limited interaction with people with disabilities had been just in my own electorate. And being the Shadow Minister, I took the opportunity to really get involved in some of the key debates at that time. And one of the key issues at that time was non-clinical mental health. Okay. And that took me to a lot of different organisations and obviously the traditional areas of people with physical and intellectual disabilities was very confronting. And I got a big appreciation for the importance of that sector, the importance of people who are carers for people with disabilities and people who care for older people in our community, people who care for young children in our community where there's issues with family, say, such as foster children or kids in emergency accommodation. That was a very formative time for my time in politics, but I suppose I then went on to be Shadow Minister for Agriculture, which was a more traditional role for me, coming from North Queensland, from regional Queensland. I very much enjoyed that too, and it was a surprise, I think, when the LNP was successful in 2012, that I was asked to be the Minister for Natural Resources and Mines in the LNP government. So I'd had a lot to do with natural resource management before. That is largely the management of land and water resources and vegetation management policy. Those are the key sort of issues in the natural resources side of the portfolio. But I'd never really had any exposure to the mining industry and the types of policy development around the mining industry. was a very new experience for me, and something that was a little bit intimidating for someone who was 31 and coming into a portfolio where the resources sector was acknowledged as one of Queensland's key pillars of the economy. A major export earner, a major revenue earner for the government through royalties, a major industry involved in regional economic development. But it was a challenge that I very much relished. I approached that responsibility by really throwing myself into a process of rapidly acquiring the information and the knowledge I needed to understand how the legislation impacted on the industry. I didn't necessarily create a good impression with all of the different parts of the resources sector, because I think that they had developed an understanding of the way that the mining industry worked in Queensland under a very long period of Labor governments. And my approach was a little bit different from that. And I think that there was, as you would know, a big expectation that there was going to be widespread reform of all policy areas in that LNP government, and certainly that was something that I was very focused on, and I didn't waste time in getting stuck into a reform agenda in the natural resources and mines portfolio.
Sure. Well, thanks, Andrew. And you seem, you know, from before I even knew you, you're a guy who's very principled, and that's a perception that I think is a, you know, has been borne out by getting to know you, you know, very much. And was there anything in yourself personally about, you know, not just policy, but differentiating yourself between, you know, your conduct as a politician and differentiating yourself from other politicians, like personally? Did you have to change style or substance, or was it really just a matter of like being who you are and then bringing that to the portfolio as well? Can you comment a bit on that?
Yeah, I'd certainly like to think that I brought a coherent policy approach to my responsibilities as minister. In the 6 years that I'd spent in Parliament prior to becoming a minister, I tried to maintain a level of reasonableness about my approach to politics. I was always trying to be about the issue, the policy, the merits of the argument, and that was
play the bull, not the man.
Yeah,
sort of thing.
Yeah, yep. Play the bull, not the man. I suppose I couldn't claim to do it 100% of the time, because politics is a bit of a cutthroat business. And if you're going to survive, you need to be able to be aggressive when you need to be aggressive and push home the advantage. But overwhelmingly, I tried very hard to master my brief. And to be across the details of the policy. And I carried that through to my time as minister. And I think that that was largely acknowledged, that the stakeholders in the sector, from both sides of the portfolio, and even to an extent the opposition at the time, recognised that if they were going to ask me a question, say during question time, they really had to have their facts straight, and they really had to have a very strong understanding of the situation, because I think that they appreciated the fact that I would know, it would be unlikely that I wouldn't know the details of the situation. But that resulted as from a lot of hard work, getting across the briefs and getting across the material that was presented to me as minister, and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah,
I have to say that my time as minister was the most professionally rewarding period of my time in the Parliament. Because I was able to get things done. There was key reform areas that I was very proud of. And I didn't waste any time. I had a good relationship with my staff and the officers in my department. And they all knew that the direction that I expected that we were going in. And what we wanted to achieve from that. And so I was very pleased with the outcomes of that reform process that we achieved in just under 3 years.
Yeah, sure. And look, as a former public servant myself in Canberra, but also at a state level, I think that's something you always appreciate, is just clear and solid direction, especially, you know, from a public policy point of view and from the continuity of government, but also from the political, you know, right from the minister down. So, absolutely. Look, I was looking at a recent interview that Jerry Seinfeld had with Barack Obama, and then, you know, the theme of that, or one of his questions, was that politics is a lot of grind, and you've alluded to it before. And I think Obama said that it's like the NFL, block, tackle, hold, and you try to move the ball down the field as much as you can. You're a rugby union man, and I think from your frame, you're probably a forward, I presume. So feel free to use a relevant analogy, but that's obviously what politics is like, block, tackle, hold, or, you know, crouch, touch, hold, engage.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that people who rely on set plays in politics are not going to get very far. Yeah. Politics is broken play. Yeah. It's a lot of rolling malls. There's a lot of joining the ruck, and there's a lot of leaving the ruck, and there's a lot of coming back in. There's a lot of people getting found at the bottom of the mall, you know, with stud marks on their back.
A few high tackles.
Yeah, there's a few high tackles. And there's a bit of gouging and some facial massaging in there. It's an untidy business, I must say. Mm. And I think that, yeah, people who think it's an exact science or an exact exercise, they're let down when they come in to participate in it, because it's not a clean profession. It's something that takes a lot of compromise to achieve the outcomes. You need a lot of stamina.
Sure.
It's hard to be in a process where you probably need to compromise to achieve your outcomes, but at the same time try to maintain your principles while doing so. And so I think, you know, you can't always get what you want in politics, but you get what you need. Now, that's a Rolling Stones song. I very much enjoyed it, and the outcomes that you can achieve are worth doing it for the people that you represent.
Sure. Yep. Right, absolutely. And, you know, just to continue the rugby analogies or the sports analogies, it sort of seems, though, that, you know, despite the high tackles and the sort of rucks and mauls and all that sort of stuff, that it does seem, though, if you're playing by fair rules, that the odd forward pass gets awarded a lot more than... or gets less picked up, pardon me, a lot more than what used to previously. Have things changed politically in terms of, well, even just in current affairs and the media cycle and all of that stuff, and your time since you got involved in politics formally? And is it good, or is it for good or worse, or what are your thoughts, Andrew?
Oh, politics is definitely a more difficult game these days, and that is because it's so transitory. You know, there's nothing more permanent in politics than the temporary. Things that are so on one day may not be so the next.
Yeah.
And so your flexibility and your capacity to adjust,
sure,
is a big part of your success. To a certain degree, I wasn't very successful at that.
Okay.
I have to say, if there was something that I didn't do well, it was responding to shifting sands and challenges of public relations exercises. And that's a bit of a downfall from my personality. I'm committed to the details and the integrity of the reform process. And I would have done better, I think, and been more successful had I been willing to be more flexible. But I was trying to achieve certain outcomes. I know I'd done the work to achieve the best possible outcome in that regard, and I suppose I wasn't always willing to make those changes or entertain those compromises to get it through in an easier and a quicker fashion. I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing. Of course, cheap and nasty solutions aren't always the best solutions, but sometimes they're the most politically expedient.
Sure. Yep. And look, I just to sort of change gears for a second, you know, from working in politics myself, but obviously never being in the same position as you, but I have spent time working for a minister in the same government and then also for a Lord Mayor. And I know that there's just huge amounts of, not drain, but there's so many pressures on your time where you're not, you don't have that time and that space or that cadence to think or to even read. And one of the things I wanted to ask you, Andrew, is do you read to stimulate your mind and sharpen your intellect? Do you do that then? And do you do that now?
I've always read extensively and widely from a young age, and that was very much encouraged by our family.
Yeah.
I have to say that during the period that I served as a minister, I did very little reading outside of the reading that was required for work. I had really no time for recreational reading, which I missed a great deal. Since leaving the ministry and since leaving politics, I have had more time for recreational reading. I like reading biographies. I like reading histories. I like reading some non-fiction that's outside of that sort of professional area. I like reading a lot about things, say, about Scotland,
yeah.
and the history of England, which is
yeah.
sort of my cultural background.
Sure.
Now, half my family's Scottish by descent and half my family's English by descent.
Yeah.
I like reading North Queensland history about yeah. where I'm from. Fiction, I read yeah. some fiction, but not as much as probably other people do. Mm. I very limited amounts that I can read it when sure. you're really that busy.
Yeah, fair yeah. enough. Absolutely. I actually just listened to an interview the other day, and it was actually Niall Ferguson, Henry Kissinger's biographer, and then Kissinger always made the point that a lot of political leaders like yourself come to a position and you can't, it's very hard to build your intellect on the run or when you arrive at that position of responsibility, so you really have to marshal all your intellect and capabilities before you actually arrive at that position of responsibility. It's just an interesting thing, and that's obviously something you've brought with you mm. as well. I didn't realize you had the Scottish heritage. Mm. You know, Adam Smith, there's a lot there, and David Hume.
Mm. Liberal.
So yeah, yes, that's right. Mm. So a lot to be proud of there. Now, you've touched on policy making and politics and you know, your key achievements, and then your you know, carers and mental health and disability, and that being teased out as something that, you know, jumped out to you, in addition to, you know, all that comes with natural resources, water or land. Anything that you're to build on that you're particularly proud of, but then what do you think are the main policy challenges facing Queensland and Australia going forward from what you've done so far?
Just on your last question, one thing I should have said was that the best way that I found to relax and to let off steam and cool my head while I was, you know, in those high pressure positions was mowing the lawn. Okay. Mowing the lawn didn't require me to think at all. I just had to follow the mower around, you know, and put the wheel next to the yeah. next to the grass that I'd mowed last time.
Would
have
been a
ride-on
mower?
No, push mower. It was my little block at home takes about an hour to mow
yeah.
behind the push mower, and it was an hour when I couldn't hear the mobile phone ring,
yeah.
and I didn't really have to think too much. And everyone's got to find that yeah. find that activity
sure.
where they can clear their head.
Yeah.
And I actually found that a lot of my best thinking was done when I was pushing the mower around.
Mm.
And it became a bit of a joke with my staff in the ministerial office, is that you've got to watch out
yeah.
when the minister's mowed the lawn on the weekend, because he's usually thought about a few things and he'll have some jobs to hand out.
A bit of red marks on the... yeah.
But my record... as Minister for Natural Resources and Mines is probably built around the reform of land management,
sure.
where we implemented the new freeholding mechanism for people to get an affordable way to move from leasehold to freehold land in Queensland. We removed the Del Bessie agreement process, which was very onerous and disadvantaged landowners who were forced to give up part of their land for national parks at lease renewal processes. In the area of water management is very controversial in most jurisdictions, no less in Queensland than anywhere else. And it was the first time we had an opportunity to modernise the Water Act in Queensland for about a decade and a half since it was introduced in the year 2000. That was a big reform process. Vegetation management reform was a very significant reform process that I undertook. The rationale behind that was to remove some of the more punitive and disgraceful provisions in that piece of legislation that treated landholders like criminals, worse than criminals actually. They were not entitled to refuse to give evidence against themselves. The mistake of fact was not a defence. The reversal of the onus of proof was in place. So in fact, the criminal code wouldn't tolerate some of those things, but they were in place for the Vegetation Management Act in Queensland. We reduced red tape through the introduction of a lot of self-assessable codes, which was much easier for the department and for landowners to administer. We delivered property rights back to property owners in Queensland by deregulating the management of regrowth vegetation, which was taken away in 2009. And we provided for a mechanism for the agriculture sector to grow in Queensland by creating permits for high-value agriculture and high-value irrigated agriculture. Beyond that, in the mining sector, we laid the foundations for the development of a uranium mining industry.
For a second. Yeah, sure. I'm really sorry. Look, I just think that on that veg management one, because it's a really interesting point about all the reforms that you had to put in place, and it sounds almost like you had to wheel things back from a really, not draconian, but that sort of concept of guilty until proven innocent and all that. You know, how did it even get to that level, do you think? It was obviously creeping policy encroaching over a sustained period of time, but how do you think it even got to that place in the first place that made you or compelled you to do those reforms in the first place?
Yeah, well, interestingly, the first time that there was regulation on the management of vegetation in Queensland was not the Vegetation Management Act in 1999, but the reform of the Land Act in 1994 was the first time that there was regulations placed on the management of vegetation on land in Queensland. And since the election of the Beattie government, the political situation in Queensland is such that the Labor governments or Labor Party relies on preferences from the Greens political party in a number of seats around the state for them to be successful at elections. And so a relationship has developed in Queensland. Every time an election comes along, the Greens write to the Labor Party and outline the things that they want changed to make it more and more difficult. From their perspective, they think that they're protecting the environment, but from my perspective and from the perspective of my party, over the last several iterations of that legislation, before we reformed it, it was placing extraordinary, outrageous and punitive restrictions on the ability of people who had purchased land to manage it properly. And I often use the analogy to explain it to people, or attempt to explain it to people in urban environments, that if you buy a 4-bedroom, 2-bathroom house in Brisbane, and you pay good money for that, money you've worked hard for, you've saved, you've invested in your home, and then the government comes along and says, I'm going to lock the door of that bedroom and that bedroom and that bathroom, and you can't use those bedrooms and that bathroom anymore in your house. And you're entitled to say, but that's ridiculous. We've paid for those bedrooms. We've paid for that bathroom. And now you're going to take it away from me. Why? well, we've decided it's the best thing for Queensland, for you to lose two of your four bedrooms, yeah, and for you to lose one of your two bathrooms. Yeah. It's an outrageous proposition to do to someone who allegedly owns the property, mm, but can't manage the property in their best interests.
Yeah.
But that, you know, that's been a seminal reform point. Yeah. In opposition, after we lost the election in 2015, Labor tried to overturn all those changes. We were successful in defending those reforms in the hung parliament, but it appears that those reforms will now be overturned now that there is a majority Labor government here in Queensland. But beyond vegetation management in the mining sector, we did a lot of reforms around the notifications and objections process. I wasn't very successful with that, achieving the outcomes that we wanted to achieve there. The community didn't have confidence in that process, unfortunately. It was one of those occasions where we just failed to explain what we were trying to achieve effectively.
Yep.
We didn't want to take away the rights of landowners. We didn't take away the rights of landowners to have their say about proposed resource projects. But what we did try to do was to say that, you know, activist groups from Amsterdam or from New York couldn't fund activist campaigns in Queensland and deliberately and strategically delay projects when they really had no direct interest in the proposal itself.
Sure.
Anyway, those things really didn't happen. As far as we were concerned, we weren't successful in explaining to the community what we were trying to achieve for economic development in regional Queensland. I suppose one of the last reform areas that I want to mention was the really important one to me personally was that we changed legislation in Queensland to allow Indigenous Queenslanders to own their own homes in freehold for the first time in their own communities.
Yeah, sure.
Up until that point in time, in Dogit communities, the land had been held collectively in freehold by that community.
The acronym there, Dogit, is
Deed of Grant in Trust.
Yep.
And those communities, several of which across Queensland, was Aboriginal freehold land, but it was held collectively by that community. The opportunity that they now have is for decisions to be made at the community level for those properties to be selected and made available to be owned in freehold by individuals, which, you know, I think that there's a dream of every Queenslander, regardless of their background, to own their own home. And they can do that now in Queensland, and those were some of the reform areas that I was fortunate enough to be involved in, and for which I'm very proud.
Excellent. Well, I think Adam Smith would be proud, given that you're, you know, there's the theme of property rights has been constant throughout your political career, especially in policy reform. So I think you'd be, and Mr. Hume as well, be very proud. Just sort of revolving back to what we were talking about at the sort of start of the interview was, and one of the things I wanted to ask you was, how do you drive people to get more involved in politics, and do we actually need more people in politics, or young people in particular?
We need a lot more people to be involved in politics. We need a lot more people of all ages to be involved in politics. But we do particularly need a lot of younger people to be involved in politics, because the decisions that we make today are going to impact them for the longest period of time, until they can affect change of some other type. It's really hard. I mean, I visited a lot of schools during my time as a Member of Parliament, and it was difficult to try and come up with effective messages to explain what these politicians are talking about when they see them on the TV or in the paper, or, you know, what are they arguing about? How does it impact on me? Well, I tried to explain to them that so many decisions made by governments influence them on a day-to-day basis from when they open their eyes in the morning. You know, the cost of power is influenced by government decisions. They get up in the morning, they turn the light on, then they turn the kettle on to have a cup of tea and cook their toasts.
Yeah.
You know, then they drive to school.
Yeah.
Well, the fact that the car is registered,
yeah,
and what they paid for the registration, and the fact that you have to be licensed to drive a car and the conditions under which you get that license, the road rules, all those things are influenced by government decisions and public policy. The fuel that's in the car is taxed. And you get to school. Why are you going to school? Because the government's decided that you will go to school from a certain age. And what you learn there, what you learn there is decided by government policy about the curriculum. The skills and responsibilities of the teacher that's at school is all determined by government policy. The bloody school's owned by the government in a lot of cases. Apart from your Catholic and private schools. And so on and so forth. Every day their life is touched so significantly. And you try to reach out to young people and explain, you know, this is impacting on what you can take when you go fishing, if you enjoy fishing. It impacts on you when you go to the nightclub and how much tax you pay on your favourite drink.
How much of you consume.
And how much you consume.
And when and what time.
And where and when and how and what time and so on and so forth. And so you can't get away from government decisions. It impacts and influences your life every day, all the time, relentlessly. And only when they understand that will it become not uncool to be involved in making decisions about how their life is going to be influenced. You know, you can talk about when they become taxpayers and they, you know, they go into this feeling, oh, well, why does tax go out at that rate? Why do I pay that much income tax? If I'm not working, how much am I getting paid in Social Security? All those decisions are made by governments. And so if you're not part of the process, how can you complain about it? How can you grizzle about it if you're not willing to participate and be involved? And that's the stories that I try to tell young people to explain why it's important to be involved in politics. Certainly, it's not cool. It's often referred to as show business for ugly people. And that is right. Just look at me. But what we've got to really understand is that if people continue to refuse to be engaged in politics, then the quality of decision making is going to decline, because it won't be representative of the people that, you know, with the majority of people that we're supposed to make decisions on behalf of.
Look, it's a great answer, and I think it actually explains a lot of your involvement in politics, sort of going back to the beginning. It's you can't escape government. Government is always going to be around, and it just seems that there's always that impulse to encroach upon people's lives, and especially by the other team to what you that you're on. I just wanted to wrap up by, and I had here, any tips for aspiring young politicians or policymakers or public servants as well, or just people in general that you'd like to broadcast? The Jacobs Podcast has a growing audience, and so this is your forum to actually just broadcast anything you want to, but in particular that message to younger people that you've just espoused, but anyone else as well, Andrew.
I think one of the most important skills that I took out of my tertiary education was that you cannot necessarily trust the information that's put in front of you just because it's written down. You need to be discriminating about what you accept as fact, and that's increasingly becoming the case in the 21st century with all of our electronic media platforms. Things are really easy to publish. And so you have to be careful about what you accept as fact. I think you need to also not be afraid of your values, not be afraid of the fact that your values may or may not be different from your friend, your neighbour, your other family members, but you need to be brave enough to test them against real world examples, test them against the classical philosophies that are put forward and associated with politics. Test out what and who you are, and you don't need to neatly fit inside a classification. You don't neatly need to fit with a label. The most important thing is to understand clearly what you believe, why you believe it, test it against those things that confront you, and then if you're satisfied that it's a reasonable position to take, then be proud of it, advocate for it, defend it, and be part of trying to see those principles and those value systems implemented to the benefit of the community in which you live. I think that people need to be motivated to be involved, not give up just because you experience a few setbacks in life, particularly in politics. But at the end of the day, I always say to people, in life, your family comes first, your livelihood comes second, and politics comes third. And if you adhere to those broad brush rules, then I think eventually, you know, you'll be successful in life.
Andrew, thank you very much. That's a great message to finish on, and thank you very much for joining me on the Jacobs podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. It's a pleasure to talk to you, and I wish you all the very best for the future as well.
Thank you, listeners. That wraps up episode 5 of the Jacobs podcast. Please get in touch at seanjacobs.com.au if you have any insights for further discussion or if you have any feedback at all. Thank you once again for listening, and hope you tune in next time.